picture a county fairground in the summer of 1920, Iowa, or maybe Indiana. Honestly, it doesn't matter which state, because this scene played out in all of them. The smell of popcorn and engine oil mixing in the August heat. A crowd in their Sunday clothes, standing in a field, necks craned back. And above the tree line, a Curtis Jenny banking into a lazy turn. Its engine rattling like a typewriter full of gravel, trailing a thin ribbon of oil smoke across a cloudless sky. For most of those people in that field, this was the first time in their lives they'd ever seen an airplane close enough to hear it breathe. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today we're going to talk about a young woman who stood in one of those fields, looked up at that airplane, and decided she was going up there. Not someday, not if the world made room for her. Not if someone gave her permission. She just decided her name was Phoebe Jane Fairgrove. Most of the world would come to know her as Phoebe Omley, and by the time the 1920s were finished with her, she would hold a federal pilot certificate that no woman in the United States had ever held before. Then she'd spend the next decade helping to build the aviation infrastructure that would carry this country into the modern age. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, the barnstorming era. It was built on two things, cheap airplanes and short memories. The United States came out of the First World War with a staggering surplus of military aircraft. The Curtis Jenny, designated the JN-4, was the backbone of the Army's pilot training program during the war. They built thousands and thousands of them, fabric over spruce, 90 horsepower up front, top speed of maybe 75 miles an hour on a calm day, designed to teach young men to fly. Forgiving enough that a student could bend one and walk away, sturdy enough that a showman could bend one on purpose and call it part of the act. When the armistice came, the government had a problem. All those Jennies sitting in fields and depots from Ohio to California, slowly turning into expensive lawn furniture. They couldn't keep them. They couldn't burn them. So they sold them for around $300 apiece. Think about that for a moment. In 1919, 2021, you could buy a complete flyable airplane for roughly the cost of a new Ford Model T. A young veteran pilot, 22 years old, 100 hours in his logbook, and no employer in sight, could scrape together $300 from savings and poker winnings and his mother's grudging contribution and come out the other end owning his own aircraft. And the skies over America filled up with those young men. They'd pick a direction and fly until they spotted a town big enough to draw a crowd, put the airplane down in a field outside of it, walk into the general store and announce that there was an airplane out in the Henley Field, and for $5 a ride, you could be the first person in this county to touch the clouds. $5 was real money in 1920. Some weeks it was a family's entire grocery allowance, and they paid it anyway. Because Americans had read about airplanes in the papers, had seen the photographs from the war, and now here was a real one right outside of town. And the man who flew it was standing in their general store with a leather jacket and goggles pushed up on his forehead, asking them directly whether they were brave enough. Most of them were.
The barnstormers had to be part aviator, part carnival barker, and part traveling salesman to survive. The act had to pay for the fuel. The fuel costs had to leave something for food, and the food had to carry you to the next town. No margin for a bad show, no safety net when the weather grounded you for 3 days, and the field you'd landed in turned to mud. That's where the wingwalkers came in. $5 for a joyride was good business. But add a wingwalker to the spectacle, somebody who climbs out of the cockpit in flight and walks along the upper wing of a biplane, and now you've got something people will drive 20 miles on a dirt road to see, something they'll talk about for the rest of their lives. Phoebe Jane Fairgrove was born in Des Moines, Iowa, in 1902. She was, by all accounts, not the kind of girl who found contentment in sitting still. When the barnstormers came through Iowa in the early 1920s, she didn't watch from the crowd like everyone else. She walked up to the operation afterward and asked what it would take to get into the air. The answer for a young woman with no money, no connections, and no logbook was blunt. You don't start in the cockpit, you start on top of the wing. Wing walking was not a metaphor. You stood on the upper surface of a biplane in flight, with 70 miles an hour of slipstream trying to peel you off like a stamp in the rain. You walked along the leading edge while the pilot held altitude and prayed you didn't upset the trim. You hung from the wing struts by your hands. You transferred between two aircraft in midair, reaching from one wing to another while both pilots struggled to hold formation and the crowd below watched from behind their hands. The safety equipment was, depending on the day and the outfit, a rope, a homemade harness,
and the understanding that the single most effective safety device was your own grip strength and your ability to read what the airplane was about to do before it did it.
People died at this. Regularly. The barnstorming era was magnificent and it was brutal, and it did not distinguish between the careful and the careless when something went wrong. The newspapers ran the fatalities on the front page, and the crowd still came the next weekend. Phoebe was good at it. She was small, she was quick, and she possessed the kind of physical intelligence that the work demanded. She could feel the buffet that meant the pilot was adding power. Feel the subtle pitch change that meant a bank was coming. She adjusted her weight and shifted her grip before the maneuver fully developed, which was the only way to stay on top of an airplane that was actively trying to shake you loose. She did parachute jumps, she did mid-air transfers between aircraft. She built a reputation across the Midwest as a performer who put on a show every single time, regardless of conditions, but she wasn't out there for the applause. Every performance was a classroom, every moment she was on that wing. She was watching what the pilot was doing 8 feet below her in the cockpit. Throttle inputs, rudder corrections. The way a skilled pilot made a coordinated turn feel smooth and inevitable. The way a less skilled one made it feel like a negotiation between himself and the aircraft that neither of them was winning. She was memorizing all of it, building a mental picture of flight from a vantage point most pilots never have. And then she met Frank Omley. Frank was barnstorming out of Minneapolis, a capable pilot and a decent showman. More important, he was willing to teach. He traded her flight instruction for her work on the wing, which was a fair exchange for both of them. She soloed quickly, faster than most students did, and it surprised people who hadn't been paying attention to what she'd actually been doing during all those hours on top of the airplane. Frank and Phoebe eventually married. They moved their base of operations south to Memphis, Tennessee, which offered better weather for year-round flying than the Minnesota winters. They established Mid-South Airways and began building something more durable than a barnstorming circuit, a real air service. Charter flights, instruction, maintenance work, the kind of operation that could survive the lean weeks. But Phoebe kept flying hard. She competed in the early national air races. She set altitude records in a monocoque. She took on work in Hollywood, where the early aviation pictures coming out of the studios needed performers who could actually fly the aircraft while the camera rolled. Not someone sitting in a prop cockpit on a soundstage. Someone who could take a director's instruction, fly the shot with precision, then fly it again if the light was wrong. She could do all of that. Now, here's where it gets interesting. The 1920s were the decade American aviation started to get serious about itself. The Air Commerce Act of 1926 gave the federal government authority to certify pilots and aircraft for the first time. The Department of Commerce created a formal licensing system, and the top of that system was the Transport Pilot's License. That was the rating you needed to carry passengers for hire, to fly the airmail routes, to operate commercially in the framework of a modern aviation industry. Earning it required a substantial number of flight hours, an instrument flying endorsement, a medical examination, written examinations covering weather, navigation, regulations, and aeronautics, and a practical test with an examiner who had no particular interest in giving it away. In 1929, Phoebe Omley passed every element of it. She became the first woman in the United States to hold a transport pilot's license, not the first woman to hold a student certificate or some limited rating. The transport license, the identical credential that the airmail pilots held, the same standard the captains flying Ford trimotors across the country had been certified to. Same requirements, same examiners, same threshold. She was 26 years old. I want you to sit with what that meant in 1929. The aviation industry was dominated by men who had learned to fly in the war or in the barnstorming years that followed. The airlines were just getting started, still more novelty than institution. The airmail routes were the proving ground for what commercial aviation might one day become. The whole system was young and rough and argued over, and it was not, to put it politely, a world that had been designed with her in mind. And there she was, holding the highest pilot certificate the federal government issued. She was not done. The 1930s brought the Roosevelt administration and the New Deal. And the New Deal had opinions about aviation. The federal government wanted airports, it wanted infrastructure, it wanted the physical and administrative framework of a modern aviation nation. Phoebe Omley went to Washington. She served as special advisor for air intelligence to the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. And she took on the directorship of the Bureau of Air Commerce's airmarking program, which was one of the more ingenious and underappreciated federal efforts of the era. The airmarking program was this. The Bureau organized workers and volunteers across the country to paint town names, compass arrows, and airport identifiers on rooftops, water towers, grain elevators, and any other prominent structure visible from the air.
a pilot navigating by sight, following roads and rivers and landmarks, could look down at a water tower and read exactly where he was. Look at an arrow painted on a warehouse roof and know which direction the nearest airport lay and how far. This was the 1930s version of moving map navigation. And Phoebe Omley designed and ran the program that put it in place. She testified before Congress about airport infrastructure at a time when most American towns didn't have a paved surface long enough to land on. She argued for flight training programs that would expand who could participate in aviation, not restrict it. She understood, because she had lived it, that aviation grew when more people could access it, when more towns had somewhere to land, when more pilots could find their way without getting lost. Frank Omley was killed in an aircraft accident in 1936. She kept working. She kept working through the war years, when American aviation transformed almost overnight from a civilian pastime into the industrial engine of a global conflict. She kept working through the post-war expansion, when the airlines that had been tentative experiments in the 20s became the dominant form of long-distance travel in this country. A career that began when she walked up to a barnstorming outfit as a teenager and refused to be turned away. She was inducted into the National Aviation Hall of Fame in 1993. She died in 1978, at 75 years old. Here's the thing I want to leave you with. The barnstorming era gets romanticized, and it deserves some of that romance. The Jennies over the fields. The wing walkers leaning into the slipstream. The $5 rides over a county fair that gave ordinary Americans their first look at what the world looked like from above. All of that is worth remembering. But the barnstorming era wasn't only spectacle, it was a pipeline. It built pilots who became airmail pilots who became airline captains. It built mechanics who became engineers. It put aviation in front of millions of Americans who had never sought it out and might never have found it otherwise. It created a country that understood what flight was, what it could do, and what it was worth investing in. Phoebe Omley started on top of a wing because that was the only way in. She ended up in Washington, building the system that would carry the next generation into the air. That is what barnstorming built, not just the show. The people sources today include the National Aviation Hall of Fame's Phoebe Omley biography, archived records from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, and the Bureau of Air Commerce's historical documentation. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Safe skies.